Okay. All right, let's... Mr. Jeffries?
I'm hearing this started.
Okay. All right. Mr. Briggs, item number four.
So, item number four is called Performance Measurement Results. And you might recall that earlier Dominic talked about performance measurements and having metrics and that sort of thing. And what I was talking about were results, although I didn't talk so much about actual water quality results. So in a way, I was talking about tangible results that hopefully lead to various water quality improvements. In some cases, I was talking about real tangible water quality improvements, for example, improvement in the fishery. I mean, that's a real environmental improvement. But some of the other things that are structural, you know, you think they must lead to water quality improvements, but they're actually one tier removed from those actual tangible results. So those are the kind of things we're talking about with performance measurements and results. And one other thing I'll add before Michael launches into this is that I see you've got State Board up here on one of the slides. There was a question earlier about, well, are we alone in doing this? And we are not with this topic, because the State Board has just initiated in the last year a report card kind of a thing on its website. And I gave you in your write-up some screenshots just as examples of some of those metrics that state and regional boards are developing for these performance measurements. And that's something that was the first step. And the state board and the regional boards aim to provide metrics that are more complete, that will be focused on the end result, the tangible results of water quality improvement, environmental results, because that's really why we're doing our jobs. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thanks, Roger. So what I mentioned is that this is more of a discussion than not, but every time I say that, it ends up just being a presentation anyway, so I have high hopes for that. But certainly Lisa and Bill and Sheila and Taya and John and Harvey jump in when we're talking about these measures and the challenges that you're going through on a day-to-day basis and trying to develop them and use them. Because that's what we actually want to get. As Roger said, it's not a new thing. State Board's been working on it for a couple of years, and so have we. And there can be conflicts there sometimes. I think the good news is that we're going in the right direction. I think the State Board is getting better at measuring things that matter. And one of the rules that we're trying to follow at the regional board staff level is to not measure dumb things. And we still do measure some dumb things, but we're trying to do less of that. We're trying to measure more of the important tangible things, as Roger was talking about. Things that have to do with the real world outdoors and improvements. Things that we can actually measure improvements outdoors. And some of the things that sometimes that when we have a conflict with the State Board or other agencies like EPA, is they'll have us count things that we think of as beans or widgets, like how many permits do we issue each year? And how many inspections do we do each year? And so at the beginning of the year, we'll pick a number. And then we're going to issue 20 permits, or 30 permits, or 50 permits. So we're going to write two TMDLs, or five TMDLs. And then at the end of the year, if we haven't done that, we're like, well, that didn't quite measure up. We didn't do five, or we didn't issue 50 permits, or we didn't do 10 inspections. So for us, those things are not really valuable. That's more like bean count, because it doesn't measure changes in the real world. It doesn't measure reductions in pollution or improvements in water quality. So what we're trying to do is shift, and what we have been trying to do is shift our attention onto more tangible measures. And why are they important? Because if we're not measuring those things, there's no way we can hold ourselves accountable for making actual improvements. So the reason why they're important is because it's how we are held accountable. It's how the public knows that we are reducing pollutant loads and improving water quality. It's how we know it. We know that we're doing meaningful work. As you're aware, the state's in a pretty serious budget situation. We've had several decreases over the past couple of years. There's another coming in the budget for this year. And that, as we lose funding and we're losing positions, we've lost, I think, five positions.
Six.
Six positions in the last 2 years. And we have been told by a state board budget person that we're going to get another 10% reduction in salary this coming fiscal year. So that means that as we lose people, we can't replace them. So we're going to have to lose six or seven more people and not be able to replace them. So the prioritization of our work becomes more and more important. As we lose people, we have to decide what we're not going to do. We also have to look at what we're doing and make sure that we're focused on the most important things, the biggest problems that the Water Board is facing. So that's a question that we have. We are constantly asking ourselves this question. Are we focused on our biggest water quality issue? And I wanted to go to a slide to try and illustrate this concept of what we are focused on. So for lack of a better term, I'm going to call this the degree of regulation. And the scale is increasing degree of regulation. So I'm going to put activities up there that we regulate. And I've spread them out over this scale to give you an idea of their relative regulatory oversight that we provide. So for timber harvesting, for example, on the far left, that's very low level of regulation we're currently doing. And the arrow shows that that's decreasing. It has been decreasing over the past several years because our resources, our available resources for doing timber harvesting have been decreasing. For stormwater, we're increasing the regulatory oversight. We're adding requirements and more comprehensive requirements. We're doing more thorough reviews of the work that municipalities are doing. So we're spending a lot of time and a lot of energy and effort on stormwater, and we're increasing our level of oversight. The acronym there is wastewater treatment plants. We have a high degree of regulation over wastewater treatment plants. As you know, you've seen those permits and you've approved those permits, where they're very specific, and they have specific effluent limits, and they have comprehensive weight monitoring and reporting programs, and they have to collect data and submit that data to us. And when there are violations, we take enforcement action. So we have a high degree of oversight for wastewater treatment. Another example is the Olin Corporation, which you're all familiar with, well, the board members are familiar with. It's one of our biggest groundwater cleanup sites. It's a perchlorate problem in Morgan Hill. Cost for cleanup there is about $250 to $300 million.
Over the long term,
that's the cost to comply with the board's requirements to clean up that site. Close to $300 million. There's several hundred residents who are affected by that pollution problem and have had to have replacement water because the groundwater is polluted, their wells are polluted. So
well,
very high degree.
Pardon? It's getting much better. There's only 16 households right now that are.
Landfills is another activity that we regulate. They are heavily regulated because obviously they're taking material in. There's a strong likelihood or potential for pollution of groundwater. So we regulate that activity pretty heavily. So one that we're working on right now, as you know, is irrigated agriculture. And for the board members, I'd like to ask you a question. Where do you think our degree of regulation falls compared to these other activities for irrigated agriculture? Where would you put it on this scale? The current order, not the proposed order, the current order.
25%.
About a little to the right of timber.
Yeah.
Yeah, between stormwater and timber.
Yeah. It's actually at the low end of the scale when compared to all the other things that we regulate. And what we're doing, we're trying to move it forward with the new order, the draft order that we put out, moves it not quite halfway on the scale compared to these other activities.
If you think of comparison to timber, for example, remember that with timber, we required individual monitoring. And one of the reasons for the arrow going that way is that last year, the board, and that was part of the design, was to take a look at the results of that monitoring and see what to do with the monitoring program. So we actually decrease the monitoring programs.
That's water quality monitoring.
Right.
We didn't decrease visual monitoring.
Or water quality, chemistry type monitoring.
Yeah, photo monitoring.
So the approach that we're taking with irrigated ag, Lisa, jump in here and correct me if I'm wrong, but we're taking a tiered approach. with Irrigated Act. And we're trying to define those tiers now. So there will be degrees of regulation in whatever we do, in whatever approach we take. If it's one order or several orders, there will be degree of regulation, meaning there will be a tiered approach. So for some growers that we consider to be at higher risk, they will be at a higher end of regulation. For some growers that are lower risk, they'll remain here or may even be exempt. So there will be a degree of regulation for the industry. So then we need to contrast that with the degree of water quality impacts. Does our degree of regulation line up with the degree of water quality impacts? And this is where, you know, as our resources are reduced because of the budget situation, we need to really pay attention to this and say, are we focused on the things that are causing the greatest impacts? So comparing timber harvesting compared to everything else that we regulate, timber harvesting presents a very low threat to water quality and very low impacts in our region. In other regions, it's actually pretty high. In Region 5 and Region 1, they have some significant problems because the way that timber harvesting is done there is very different than here in Santa Cruz County. It's heavily regulated here, so that the actual threat is very low. Landfills, the actual threat is low, relatively speaking, on this scale, because of the degree of regulation. So our oversight has pushed down the threat from landfills. It used to be very high, the threat from landfills. It used to be not very well regulated. But over the past 20-plus years, our regulations have increased significantly and pushed down the threat. Wastewater treatment plants, the same thing. Being heavily regulated, the threat from wastewater treatment plants now is very low. Well, we do see, you know, we see minor sewage spills, we see minor effluent violations. But the real issue that exists with wastewater treatment plants are emerging pollutants. The emerging pollutants of concern. I'm saying that right? Emerging pollutants of concern. Emerging contaminants of concern. And those are things like endocrine disruptors, which we are just learning about. They have significant health impacts at very, very low concentrations, and they are very difficult to measure. So we're just starting to wrestle with that issue. Otherwise, the wastewater treatment plants would be further down on that scale as far as the threat that they pose to the environment. Stormwater. Stormwater is a misnomer, because as we talked about today during Dominic's presentation, it's not just stormwater. It's the overall activity resulting that municipalities do, all the activities that municipalities do, the infrastructure that we create, the design of their cities, roads, the discharge to groundwater, the covering up recharge areas with impervious surfaces. So stormwater is a misnomer. It's actually the design of communities that we're talking about here. That presents a large threat to beneficial uses and to watersheds on a watershed scale. So they remain a very high priority for us because of the degree of water quality impacts that result. The Olin Corporation, that kind of site. And when I have the Olin Corporation up here, I mean that as a proxy for those types of cases. I'm not just talking about that case, but groundwater cleanup cases that involve drinking water. Olin just happens to be the biggest one that we have. So the actual degree of impact, we've pushed it back because of our oversight, but it remains a high priority for us because it does affect drinking water for so many people. So where do you think, I asked you where Irrigated Ag was, on that scale, where do you think it is on this scale?
Far right.
What was that?
Far right.
Far right. Yes, it's on the far right. It's actually off the chart compared to the other activities that we regulate. The amount of pollution coming from Irrigated Ag, for instance, the amount being discharged into groundwater, the amount of nitrates being discharged into groundwater, is not comparable to anything else that we regulate.
If you irrigate agriculture out, you won't need the landfills and you won't need the wastewater treatment plants.
That's right.
Because there won't be anything to produce anything to go to the wastewater treatment plants.
Turn that around. if we're successful at every one of these things, we solve this and solve this and solve this and solve this and solve all of those, we'll still lose our water resources from that issue alone.
Well, let me ask you this. Has our regulation, I mean, some of these things like landfills, timber, WDPs, that are moving down because of our regulation, doesn't put them out of business, has it?
No.
Okay. All you're doing is moving, making them better citizens.
But on the other hand, you also have to see the wastewater treatment plants. They can go to the, they can go and raise their rates to whatever they need to cover their ass. Irrigated agriculture, on the other hand, has to conform with what people want to pay for what they want to feed. That's fair, the hard part.
Fair enough.
So when you could find the right balance there, there's no problem.
Well, I think that's what we're talking about, finding the right balance.
And the municipalities would argue the same thing as far as inability to raise revenues with Prop 218 and some other issues.
In the end, they find the way to do it.
Remember, these cases, triple this stuff. These cases, I'm using Olin Corporation as a proxy. We have literally thousands of individual cleanup cases. Over the years, tens of thousands, and most of those are individual people. They're not municipalities that we're talking about. They're people or companies that have to deal with the board's requirements to clean up that case. 6,000 underground tank cases. 6,000 of them.
Well, here's the point that's taken. You said over the last 20, 25, 30 years, you've been working hard on accidents. You've been working hard on wastewater treatment. And that's what it takes to get them to get down to the degree of water quality impacts. And the way it looks under the ag deal, you want to get it done in 3 to 5 years, and it's not going to happen. It's going to take 25 to 50 years to 100 years to get that degree of water impacts down based on history. So,
so we should get started.
No, we are started. I mean, everything is started. It's just going to take longer than you think to get there. Which is, it's not a bad thing, it's not a good thing, but that's just what it's going to take.
And I have no doubt that for growers, farmers, that it feels like we are moving them from here to here. That's what it feels like. I have no doubt. What we're going to try to illustrate and explain is that we're actually moving them here compared to everybody else, and that within that there will be tiered approach. But I'm not saying it isn't going to hurt. Some people it's going to hurt.
Well, definitely. But it's, I'm still losing somewhere along the line. On the degree of regulation, on whose degree, that's on your degree.
Right. Yes. That's from my perspective, working in this agency and overseeing all of these different activities. It's comparing that degree of regulation to these other activities. I'm not a farmer, so I'm not looking at it from a...
So the way we're looking at it, we're looking at putting all our resources into ag and letting everything else go.
No. We're still working on all of these things. But this is a very high priority. Irrigated ag is a high priority for us, number one priority for us. To prepare the draft order and all of the documentation that went along with the draft order, we had 20 people in the office working on that order at different times. 20 different people with different areas of expertise. We've never done that before. The reason we did it is because the magnitude of the problem that we're facing. The magnitude of impacts to drinking water, the cost associated with that level of groundwater pollution that's being transferred out to the public—it's so enormous that it has to warrant our highest priority and our most attention. So those two, area and stormwater, which I said is actually a misnomer because of what we're actually regulating there. Those two things are our highest priority. And other cases, like the Olin Corporation, groundwater pollution cases that are affecting drinking water, our highest priority.
Have you done a cost analysis for irrigated ag on what it's going to cost to convert and change the process?
No. What we have looked at is how much the pollution, the groundwater pollution, costs, and transfer that cost onto the public. It's hundreds of millions of dollars to remove. Like every year, like in our staff report for the May workshop, in our draft order, it talks about the amount of nitrogen that's being discharged to groundwater just in Salinas Valley, 90 million pounds. 90 million pounds per year into groundwater.
And
it has to be taken out.
Where do you get that 90 million?
Where does that come from? It comes from research that has been done by, I think it was UC, I think it was scientists with UC Extension. But we're taking that directly from research papers that have been published.
We should probably hold more details on the ag regulation for the workshop that we have tomorrow on that subject. And this is a part of performance measures, so we should probably get back to performance measurement.
Okay. Interesting topic.
Yeah. We have tomorrow pretty much dedicated to that.
Okay. So I just wanted to point out with this slide and these scales that we're in trying to be a more performance-based organization. One, we want to measure tangible results, like we've been talking about. Dominic talked about it. Roger talked about it. So we want to be able to measure tangible results, but we also want to be focused on the most important thing. If we're measuring tangible results on timber harvesting, and we're doing a fantastic job on it, relatively speaking, so what? We need to be measuring tangible results on our most important water quality issues. So that's really the gist of it.
Yeah, but the comparison of the amount of timber that we have compared to ag, irrigated ag we have in our region is there's quite a bit of difference in size. Now, other regions have more timber harvest, but have less irrigated ag. So theirs is going to be just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yeah. But they also have less restrictions. Our timber harvests are pretty restricted. They're pretty regulated. Yeah.
The main difference being in Santa Cruz County, there's only selective harvesting.
Right.
No clear cutting. So that's the big difference with the North Coast and North Central Valley areas, because they have clear cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just a huge difference in terms of what happens on the ground.
Well, but the point I'm trying to make, and I think what to go with what Michael is saying, yeah, we, you know, timber harvest is going the opposite direction because we put regulations, but the amount of timber harvest that we have to control is much different in size compared to irrigated ag.
Sure.
So with a few requirements, it changed the whole issue with the timber harvest. I see a lot more complicated issues with irrigated ag.
Yep.
It's you know, I don't see that this issue is going to take, I think John alluded to it, you know, a couple of years. It's going to be a long-term process to be able to manage this, because if you, I don't, I'll say more about this tomorrow.
Okay, so the third one there that I was attempting to answer with that diagram, are we focused on our biggest water quality issues? And we are becoming more and more focused on our biggest water quality issues. And as our budget goes down, it forces that question. It forces us to answer that question and to change to come up with prioritization criteria to apply it and change our priorities and change what we're working on. We have stopped working on many things as we change our focus and work on more important. literally, we are identifying the things that we are not working on, the low priority, low threat issues. So for the last thing, what are we measuring and how are we changing? For an example, Johnny, jump in here on the cleanup unit for Sheila or Taya. I think this is one of the more clear-cut examples, so I'll use it. And we have a case that we become aware of that's a groundwater pollution case. It threatens drinking water or it's already impacting drinking water. There are different things we can measure. We can measure how many of those we have. We have 10 of them, we have 20 of them, we have 50 of them. And we can measure how many we are closing. And how many do we have open versus how many we have closed. That doesn't really tell us how well we're doing at getting them cleaned up. So what we're trying to do is say, ask questions like, when we become aware of that case, how long does it take for them to start active remediation? That's a measure of our performance, staff level performance. If it takes a long time from the time we learn about it for them to start cleaning it up, that's a measure of our performance. If it takes a short period of time, that's a measure of our performance. We're trying to use measures like that for our direct personal performance and to hold ourselves accountable for that. So then you could say, once they start cleaning up, how long does it take for them to decrease the amount of pollution that's at that site to the point? Because if you look at a cleanup site, it'll go from high pollution, if you charted this, high level of pollution, it'll go along and down a curve to a low level, relatively low level, and then it stabilizes. So how long does it take to get down to that low level where it stabilizes? That's another measure of our performance. That's a reflection of how we are managing that site and staying on top of that site and forcing them to keep making improvements. Olin's a good example of great performance all around on the Olin Corporation's on their side of it and on our side. Our level of oversight there was intense, but Olin responded and they did the work that we required them to do. That cleanup is probably one of the fastest in the United States, the fastest moving in the United States. I think that's a direct result of our intense oversight and the board's actions on that case. So those are the kinds of things we're monitoring. Instead of just how many permits are we issuing and how many inspections are we doing, we want to measure reductions in pollutions, cleanups, how well we are actually doing at our jobs. So we're doing that more and more and more. Another example, something that we're working on right now in the stormwater program, is we got, if you remember from a couple years ago, the board said, get these municipalities enrolled. Let's stop talking about it. Let's just get them enrolled. Do all you can to get them enrolled. They're all enrolled now. So that now our question, we could say they're all enrolled, therefore we're doing a great job. That doesn't measure what the municipalities are doing to reduce pollutant loading within their jurisdiction. So now we're trying to come up with measures for the municipalities. How well are they measuring the effectiveness of their best management practices, and how are they reporting that information to us? Do we know? Can we tell from what they're reporting how well they're reducing pollutant loads? Can we tell? Can they tell? Can the public tell? Is that accurate?
Exactly.
So it's not an easy thing to do, but that's what we are focused on. We're intensely focused on measuring tangible results in everything that we do.
Michael, when you use the term cleanup, are you referring to underground tank cases?
Yeah, groundwater cleanup type.
So what I would add to that would be, and it ties into this, how many 303 delisted bodies have come off the list over time? How quickly did they come off? Or as to specific metrics in a watershed that are not making it healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you used a clock, how quickly are DEO levels coming back to where they should be?
One of the things in that area that we've been working on, that Karen Worster's been working on, and that she developed, what are you calling them? It's a water quality index. So Dominic mentioned this. He was talking about watershed health. Well, how do you measure watershed health? There are so many different parameters that you could measure. What we're coming up with are individual parameters that we put them together, and they create a matrix. And that tells us what the overall watershed health is. We can go from site to site and measure that. And we have those matrices in place, and we're starting to apply those, largely through the work of Karen.
Well, for just simple water quality standards, receiving water standards, we don't need matrices for those.
We don't.
That's either black or white.
We don't, but you use something like dissolved oxygen, for example. We can just go around, we can sample the heck out of dissolved oxygen. But it don't, but that gives us such a limited amount of information about what's actually going on at that site, that when we create this matrix of information, it gives us a lot of information about what's going on at that site. We have a better, much better indication of what we're all having. And we're working on expanding those to give us a complete picture, chemical, biological, and physical. Chemical, biological, and physical integrity of individual sites, reaches of streams, and then overall watershed. And the work that Karen's doing and her team, Karen Worcester, with the regional board's ambient monitoring program, you know, another way of measuring something is last year, through that program, we collected and uploaded 11,000 lines of data, which went into defining the 303D list of impaired water bodies. We uploaded more information than all of the other water boards and the state board combined. So we got a lot of kudos for that. And now the other water boards and the state board want to emulate that. They're trying to figure out how to do it. But does that measure our performance in reducing pollutant loads? It's one measure. It's a measure of something. It's a measure of collection of data.
How fast you can type.
But it doesn't measure whether we're reducing pollutant loads on those priority things that I had up on the screen.
No, but it's the database that you need to measure changes over time.
It's one of the tools.
It's one of the tools.
Yeah,
but by itself, it's not good enough. It's not enough.
Yeah.
And I would just add that, you know, one of the things that we're really lacking in terms of measuring is baseline. So, I mean, the accomplishment is enormous because you have a baseline now that is
pretty start
substantial
measuring
against which to measure.
It's a big accomplishment, but most agencies stop there. Uh-huh. They measure those kinds of things, and then they just keep measuring, uh-huh, without taking the actions that are necessary to reduce pollution, to deal with problems, to fix problems, like we did with the old program. Anybody want to add anything? Because I'm out of things to say.
Well, we should move on anyway, because I think we have to be out of here by 4:30.
That's all I have.
Where is staff with respect to completing its assessment phase? Because I think that is the initial phase that you're in.
The assessment of
the health of the watersheds. We've talked about this before, mm-hmm, in terms of the continuum of what you're going to be doing over many, many years.
Where are we in the
I thought you had a completion date for a targeted completion date for finishing your assessment, so that, you know, it's when all of your matrices have been determined and you've defined your parameters.
We have the indexes, what I was referring to as indexes.
Okay.
We have those established and we're starting to use them. The ambient monitoring program continues to collect data, and it's been running for a long period of time now.
11 years.
We can start to see trends in watersheds. So we have a lot of the information that we need. For instance, Dominic was talking about doing a certain degree of assessment to support the basin plan. Right. We have, I would say, the majority of the information we need to do that assessment to write the basin plan.
Okay.
It's not like we're going to go out and collect some new additional data or do something differently. We have the base data that we need, I think, to do that assessment to support the base environment.
Yeah, I think it's more accurate to say we're continuing to evaluate measures, and we haven't completely defined all of the matrices that we want to roll up into the definition of healthy watersheds.
Okay,
so for the data that we have, we've been able to do a lot of work, but we are still considering getting other information. So, whether that's extent of riparian habitat, for example, looking at layers, you know, GIS layers, and trying to figure out what we learn from that relative to our own field work that looks at physical habitat conditions.
Impervious areas.
Yeah, impervious areas. So we're still, when it comes to the regional, I'd say more physical parameters, we're still doing some evaluation, and we haven't set a specific drop-dead date for ourselves.
Okay. I thought I saw that a little bit differently. Is that it will be an ongoing thing. You know, it's not like we're going to do some assessment and stop, and then we'll have our watershed assessment. We're never going to stop. It's going to be ongoing.
Right. Maybe it's in the definition of the criteria that you're going to use, you know, to assess improvement. You know, the goal is like, what, an 80% of the watershed is going to be functioning and healthy? Was that the parameter you guys have chosen over 20 years or what, 30
years? 14
years
from now.
14 years from now?
So it's for, we've got one for groundwater, one for land use.
So do you have the metrics in place to gauge that 80% target?
So in each category, we have some metrics that we can measure that can help us assess.
Okay.
But we want to come up with better, I guess that's a multi-metric, or keep looking at, are there better ways than the accessible data that we already have, that we already collect and that we already have access to inform whether or not we could advertise something as healthy, general.
All right.
And like with, we're talking about surface water and watersheds, but it's also groundwater. And we are actively working on getting groundwater data to show the condition of the water quality in groundwater basins, and then mapping population over that to compare where we think groundwater wells exist, that where people are using groundwater wells for their domestic supply versus water quality, so where the water pollution problems are and where the domestic supply exists.
Right, where drinking water exposures exist, which would be, it's not something you can get at easily because domestic well water quality data does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to kind of take this roundabout fashion to find out where are our high-risk areas for people consuming nitrate-impacted water.
Although we just recently took a step towards correcting that problem by the letter which we sent to the board just recently that went to all the county public health officers saying we've got this big hole in terms of providing information to people who are drinking water, and asking the public health directors to help fill that hole by requiring sampling for individual domestic wells or even multi-connection wells that are falling through the regulatory cracks.
Monterey County does that already, don't they?
Yeah, it varies from county to county, and actually Monterey County is really the exception in the region.
I think five or more connections, then they have annual water quality tests.
But that still leaves the lesser connected wells and individual wells in the lurch.
And many, many of them, thousands and thousands of them.
On the order of 20,000 domestic wells just in Monterey County alone that would fit into the category that is not covered that you just described.
Well,
That's 80 to 100,000 drinkers potentially.
Water drinkers.
Yeah.
So,
isn't that the responsibility of the individual well in those cases to test their own water?
Well, they can.
Hmm?
They can if they want
to. They can. I do. Why does the government have to do that?
Well, a lot of folks are renters.
A lot of folks are what?
Renters.
Renters?
Yeah.
Is staff going to follow up with this letter that just went out with the public health agencies?
Yeah, that's our next plan.
I'd like to know what, you know, how it's received and whether how they respond to it.
We can't just send this out in a vacuum. We have to then push.
Follow up.
With respect to getting together with them and talking about how are they going to try to implement this. we can share ideas. Or there's another key issue underlying this is, okay, so now you get the sampling program in place. What are you going to do with the data? How are we going to manage the data that comes back from that in a way that tells us something, you know, that steers us?
Well, with a cut of staffs, then how? And if you have the data, what are you going to do with it?
Well, hopefully it'll inform us as to where our problem areas are.
Well, my point is, if you don't have enough staff to analyze it, what good is the data?
Well, one of the big benefits of that is in actually informing the person who's drinking the water, well, first and foremost. So
that's true. Yeah. If the information gets back to them,
right?
If there's a well that's significantly above water quality standards and nothing's being done about it, that's going to become one of our highest priority issues, like it's in the cleanup program, and we will find staff to work on it.
We have staff to work on it.
Right.
Now,
going back to Michael's image that he had up there with the arrows, that would then slide to a very high priority because it's a human health exposure, and it becomes a priority case for us. We'll be working on it.
Is this also going to include saltwater intrusion in domestic wells?
I don't know. I think the letter just covered nitrate that we were asking.
Okay. What do we do now? Are we done with...